Srimad Bhagavatam, 4th Canto, Chapter 23, Maharaj Prithu's Going Back Home, Text 19. Arichi,
Arichi
Namo,
Namo
Maharagi,
Maharagi
Tat Patni,
Tatpatni
Anugata,
Anugata
Vanam
Saram,
Sukumarya,
Sukumarya
Atad
Arha
Cha
Jat
Padbhyam
Sparshanam
Bhubaha. Arichi Namo Maharagi Tatpatnanugata Vanam Sukumarja at Sukumarja tad arhacha Jat padbhyang sparshanam bhubaha Archir namo maharagi tat patnyanugata vanam Sukumarya tad arhacha Jat padbhyang sparshanam bhubaha Archir namo maharagi Tat patnyanugata vanam Sukumarya tad arhacha Jat padbhyam sparshanam bhubaha Matajis. Archi Nama, of the name Archi, Maharagi, the queen, Tatpatni, the wife of Maharaj Prithu, Anugata, who followed her husband, Vanam, in the forest.
Sukumari.
Very delicate body.
Atad Arha.
Who did not deserve.
Cha.
Also.
Jatpadbhyam.
By the touch of whose feet.
Sparshanam.
Touching.
Bhubaha.
On the earth. Translation by His Divine Grace Srila Prabhupada. The queen, the wife of Prithu Maharaj, whose name was Archi, followed her husband into the forest. Since she was a queen, her body was very delicate. Although she did not deserve to live in the forest, she voluntarily touched her lotus feet to the ground. Please repeat.
The queen,
the wife of Prithu Maharaj,
whose name was Archi,
followed her husband into the forest.
Since
she was a queen,
her body was very
delicate. Although she did not deserve to live in the forest,
she voluntarily touched her lotus feet
to the ground. Purport by Srila Prabhupada. Because Prithu Maharaj's wife was a queen and also a daughter of a king, she never experienced walking on the ground. For queens, used to never come out of the palace. They certainly never went to the forests and tolerated all the difficulties of living in the wilderness. In the Vedic civilization, there are hundreds of similar examples of such renunciation on the part of queens and dedication to the husband. The goddess of fortune, Mother Sita, followed her husband, Ramchandra, when he went to the forest. Lord Ramchandra went to the forest in compliance with the order of his father, Maharaj Dasharath. But Mother Sita was not so ordered. Nonetheless, she voluntarily accepted the path of her husband. Similarly, Gandhari, the wife of King Dhritarashtra, also followed her husband into the forest. Being the wives of great personalities like Prithu, Lord Ramchandra and Dhritarashtra, these were ideal chaste women. Such queens also instructed the general people by showing them how to become a chaste wife and follow the husband in every stage of life. When the husband is a king, she sits beside him as the queen. And when he goes to the forest, she also follows, despite having to tolerate all kinds of difficulties in living in the forest. Therefore, it is said here, Atad Arha, that although she did not want to touch her feet to the ground, she nonetheless accepted all difficulties when she went to the forest with her husband. Archir namo maharagi tat patnanu gatavanam sukumarja tat haracha jat padbhyam sparshanam bhubaha. The queen, the wife of Prithu Maharaj, whose name was Archi, followed her husband into the forest. Since she was a queen, her body was very delicate. Although she did not deserve to live in the forest, she voluntarily touched her lotus feet to the ground. So this chapter is describing how Prithu Maharaj went back to Godhead. Prithu Maharaj going back home. It has been described in Bhagavatam how Prithu Maharaj appeared. His apparent father, King Vena, was a tyrant. Instead of protecting the citizens and taking care of them, he was torturing them and he was causing a lot of disturbance in the kingdom. Therefore, the saintly personalities, the brahmanas means self-realized
souls who were already situated in the Brahmabhuta platform, they came to advise him. And when Bena refused to listen to their advice, they cursed him. And as a result of that, Bena died. When Bena died, there was no successor to the throne. Therefore, these saintly people, the brahmanas, the sages, the very, very exalted sages, they actually churned Bena's leg, and as a result of that, Prithu Maharaj appeared. And Prithu Maharaj rectified all the mistakes that was made before his appearance on the earth. The earth planet was in a very, very critical situation at that time, and Prithu Maharaj rectified the situation and made the earth planet into a created a most wonderful situation in the earth planet. Earth planet is considered to be like a cow, like a Surabhi cow that can fulfill all desires, and by Prithu Maharaj's arrangement, Prithu Maharaj milked the mother earth, the cow, and the whole planet became full of prosperity. And then after ruling the kingdom of the earth planet for a long time, Prithu Maharaj retired to the forest, accepting Vanaprastha. This is the Vedic culture. Vedic culture teaches one to become responsible in performing his duty, and Vedic culture ultimately teaches one not to become attached at all and give up all kinds of attachments and become Krishna conscious. So these kings are actually saintly personalities. Therefore they are known as Rajarishis. They are kings, they are Rajas, but at the same time they are Rishis. Rishis means they are situated on a spiritual platform. They're perfectly situated in transcendental wisdom, and they're perfectly situated in living the life of a total renunciate. So King Prithu, although a king, but he was a rishi, he was a sage. And not only that, King Prithu was an incarnation of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. He was a Shaktavesh avatar. There are six kinds of incarnations of the Supreme Personality of Godhead, and one of them is Shaktavesh. Shaktavesh means he is a jiva. He is not the Supreme Personality of Godhead, but he is empowered by the Supreme Personality. Shakti Avesh. Shakti means potency, and Avesh means being induced by. Being induced by the potency of the Supreme Personality of God. Vasudev, Prithu Maharaj, Parashuram, Narad Muni, they are the examples of Shaktavish avatar. So Prithu Maharaj retired from his royal responsibility. He was the king. He was not only the king of a kingdom, but he was the king of the entire earth planet. And not only the earth planet, he was the king of the entire earth planet, including the oceans. Even the oceans were his domain. And he left everything. And when he left, his wife also accompanied him, although she was a queen. Queen means, she was not only a queen, she was a princess, the daughter of a king, led an extremely opulent and comfortable life of luxury and pleasure. Like here it has been described, Tatpadbhyang Jad Arhanam. Tatpadbhyang Sparshanam Bhuvaha. Sparshanam, she, that means now only she touched the earth planet, Bhuva, the ground, with her feet. Prior to that, she never touched the planet, the surface of the earth with her feet. So that is how delicate a personality she was. But she now left the palace, left the luxury of a royal life, majestic life, and now she has gone to the forest. She never walked barefoot, but now she is walking on the forest path. Often there is no path also. In the forest there is no path. And it's full of thorns and pebbles and all kinds, and filled with ferocious animals. But she followed her husband. That shows how Vedic culture is teaching everybody not to be attached. And they're prepared to face any situation. Prabhupada gives them two other examples in this respect in the purport. Sita Devi. When Ramchandra was banished, he was only 27 years old. Lord Ramchandra was 27 years old. And Sita Devi was probably 22, 23 years old. She followed her husband. She never knew anything, any hardship, but she followed her husband into the forest. Another person is Gandhari, Prabhupada giving the example. Gandhari also was a princess. She was the daughter of the king of Gandhar. And she was naturally brought up in extreme luxury and comforts. And then she was the queen mother. But when Dhritarashtra decided to leave home, Gandhari also accompanied him. And she followed him. He was blind. And she blindfolded herself. So they went to the forest. So this is the Vedic culture. What does Vedic culture establish then? What does the Vedic culture teach? Vedic culture teaches the life of detachment. Now why become attached to something which is temporary and illusory? Why become attached to something that is temporary and illusory? Therefore, the Vedic culture is the ideal human culture for human civilization. Don't become attached. This body is only a temporary covering of the soul. So don't become attached to this body. Don't become attached to the comforts of the body. Don't become attached to the possessions of the body. Always remain prepared to finish off your business here as soon as the time comes and go back to your actual home, the spiritual sky. That is our main objective. Back to God. And Prithu Maharaj's departure, as we discussed yesterday, has been so wonderfully described. When the time came for him to leave his body, he just prepared himself. He sat in yogasana. He closed all the gates of the body. Then he made his life air rise from the bottom of his spinal column to the brain center, and then he left his body. And Prabhupada very wonderfully described in, I think, the verse 14, how Prithu Maharaj prepared himself to leave his body. Like a perfect yogi, Siddha yogi. The yogis do that. Yogis master the art of opening the chakras, of the body and rise up to the brain center. On top of the head there is a hole which is not visible, but there is a hole. And it is through that hole, which is known as Brahmarantra, a yogi leaves his body. The purpose of yoga is not to open the chakras and achieve some mystic power, yoga siddhi. The ultimate purpose of yoga is to develop one's loving relationship with Krishna. Yoginam upi sarvesham madgatena antaratmanaha shraddhavan bhajate yomam same yuktotam. Krishna is describing in the 6th chapter of Bhagavad Gita, after describing the process of Ashtanga Yoga, and he is saying that tapasibhyo adhiko yogi gyani bhascha matadhika karmi bhascha adhiko yogi tasma yogi bhavajana. Just after describing the yoga process, he says the yogis are better than a tapasi, austere mendicants. Gyani bharsya matodhika. They are even superior to the gyanis. Karmi bharsya adhiko yogi. They are superior even to the karmis. Therefore, tasma yogi bhavarjuna. Arjuna, you become a yogi. But then, right after that, Krishna is telling the yoginam upi sarvesham. Among all the yogis, madgatena antaratmanaha, one whose heart and soul has become completely dedicated to me, madgatena antaratmanaha, and shraddhavan bhajate jomam, one who is serving with absolute faith in me, he is yukta tamo mataha, the most intimately connected to me. So this way we can see what is the goal of Ashtanga Yoga. The goal of Ashtanga Yoga is to become a devotee of Krishna. But that's a very arduous process. To achieve perfection in yoga, the ultimate perfection of yoga is actually to see the super soul in the heart. The process of yoga is actually an inward journey. Inward journey. Go inside, deeper and deeper and deeper within your heart. And when you go to the deepest core of your heart, what do you find there? You find the Supreme Personality of Godhead as the Super Soul. So that's the point has been made there, that when a Jiva Soul sees the Super Soul, Jiva Soul is minute. And Super Soul is the Supreme. So when a minute personality sees the Supreme Personality, what would be his mentality at that time? What will be his attitude at that time? Surrender. Surrender. Sharanagati. So surrender, that is the goal of yoga. So ultimately, after achieving the perfection of yoga, one surrenders unto Krishna, and when one surrenders unto Krishna, he becomes a devotee of Krishna. Therefore, the perfection of yoga leads one to become a devotee of Krishna. So when one has become a devotee of Krishna, therefore, it has been concluded that he has already gone through all this process of Ashtanga Yoga and other processes. Prabhupada time and time again mentioned that in his purpose. That those who have become a devotee, you have to understand that they have transcended all the other processes and they have come to this point. Normally one gradually elevates to that platform. First is karma kanda section, karma kanda, then gyana kanda, and the ultimate point of gyana kanda is actually Ashtanga Yoga. And after achieving the perfection of Ashtanga Yoga, one comes to the platform of devotional service. So that is the gradual process of elevation. But we, in the age of Kali, receive a very special benefit. We are not elevating gradually to the ultimate point. The ultimate mercy has come down upon us. It has been showered upon us. It has been given to us. Therefore, sometimes it can be compared to those who are aspiring to achieve perfection through their own endeavor is like a person who is trying to become a rich man by dint of his own endeavor. Somebody is trying to become rich by his own endeavor. First he gets a job, makes some money, then he starts his business and makes profit, and then he becomes a rich man. As opposed to a rich man's son. A rich man's son doesn't have to make an endeavor to become rich. Just by being the rich man's son, he's already rich. So those who are trying to elevate to the spiritual higher and higher platform, they are like a person who is struggling to become rich. And the devotees are like a rich man's son. Not only a rich man's son, they are like the sons of the richest personality, the supreme personality of Godhead. They don't have to make an endeavor to become rich. Just by being the son of the father, they are already inherited his wealth. So that is the actual process of Krishna consciousness. And that's why they are not attached. They are simply concerned about what my father wants. A rich man's son becomes rich when his father is pleased with him and gives him the wealth. So rich man's son has to do only one thing. Remain loyal to the father. Because if the father gets upset, then he will write him off the will. But if he is obedient to the father, then the father will give him everything. So devotee's business is to remain loyally, faithfully attached to the father. And whether a man or a woman, they display that. Here we are seeing, how is Queen Archie able to display this kind of detachment and acceptance of such hardship voluntarily? What is the secret? The secret is that she is completely dedicated to the Supreme Personality of Godhead. She is not in his body consciousness. Detachment actually means freedom from body consciousness. The more we are attached to the body consciousness, the more attached we will become the objects of our senses. But when we are free from our body consciousness, we are detached. We can afford to become detached. I'm not this body. So things that are related to the body, how important they are. But I am this body. If I think that I am this body, then anything related to the body will become so important. So when we see that someone is so detached, in spite of having any previous cultivation or previous practice or previous experience, like she is a person who did not even touch her feet on the planet, on the earth planet. She didn't touch the ground with her feet. But now she is walking in the forest. How could she do that? Because she is not at all in her body consciousness. She is so much absorbed in her Krishna consciousness, and she is extremely fortunate. She has a husband like Prithu Maharaj, who is an incarnation of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. In that way, it is also understandable that she is an incarnation of Lakshmi Devi. So, a personality like that is the perfect example for everyone to follow, or should be the perfect example for everyone to follow. And only in the Vedic culture we find such examples. Nowhere in the world, in the world history, we never come across such examples of total detachment.
Like in other parts of the world, the history tells us many, many anecdotes, many, many incidents where the son killed the father to get the kingdom. The brother killed brother to get the kingdom. Battles were fought to get the kingdom. But in Vedic culture, what do we find? The king and monarchs walked away from the kingdom. Nowhere in this world you find such example. Nowhere. That is the glory of the Vedic culture. And why they could do that? Because they were not attached. Because they had informations about the absolute reality. Therefore, they did not consider this to be a reality. They considered this material life is something like a temporary dream. A dream. A dream in relation to the body. It's not really real. When you'll finish the body, this dream will disappear. So this is the glory of the Vedic culture, and that's why it's so important that we pursue this culture, we follow this culture, and we try to establish this culture all over the world. So today is also Srila Ramanujacharya's appearance day. There are four Vaishnava sampradayas: Brahma, Rudra, Shri and Kumar. These four sampradayas, those four sampradayas respectively were started by Lord Brahma, Lord Shiva, Lakshmi Devi and four Kumars. So one of them is called Shri Sampradaya, which was started by Lakshmi Devi herself. And in that sampradaya, in Shri Sampradaya, in the age of Kali, about 1,000 years ago, almost 1,000 years ago, a great Acharya appeared. And that is Sridhar Ramanujacharya. Actually, what happened in the age of Kali, the four sampradayas became affected. Vaishnavism became affected. Buddhism, Vedic culture was practically lost by the unscrupulous activities of the so-called Brahmanas in the age of Kali. Brahmana Kalimashritya Jayante Brahmajomishu. Some demoniac personalities were born in a Brahmanan families, and they destroyed the Brahminical culture. In the name of the Vedic culture, in the name of Brahminical culture, they started to introduce all kinds of undesirable activities, all kinds of abominable activities. Like one of them was killing animals. In the name of sacrifice, all kinds of animals, innumerable animals were being slaughtered. So seeing this unnecessary animal slaughter, the heart of the Supreme Personality of Godhead became afflicted. Nindasi jagga viderahaha shruti jatam sadaya hridaya darshita poshukhatam keshavadrita buddha shadi. In order to stop unnecessary animal killing, in the name of Vedic sacrifice, Krishna appeared as Lord Buddha. And to stop the animal sacrifice, what Buddha did? Buddha came and he introduced a new religion, rejecting the Vedas. He rejected the Vedas. Because in the name of the Vedas, the animal sacrifice was going on. So he said, there is no need to follow the Vedas. Therefore, there is no need to slaughter animals. Rather, he established the religion of ahimsa, non-violence. Don't hurt anybody, don't kill anybody. And he gave 10 principles of right action: truthfulness, pursuance of dharma, and so forth. And he pointed out that the goal of life is to attain nirvana or become nothing. So in this way Buddha came and he established his new religion, rejecting the Vedas. The Vedas were rejected, Buddhism spread and no one was following the Vedas. Therefore Chaitanya Charitamrita is explaining, Ved na maniya bodho hoilo nastik. Since the Buddhists did not follow the Vedas, did not accept the Vedas, Buddhists became Nastic. Their Nastic means atheist. Buddhists are actually covered atheists. Not directly they are following atheism, but indirectly they are pursuing the path of atheism. Because they are not following the Vedas, if they don't follow the Vedas, they won't get the information about the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Therefore, they will not understand who the Supreme Personality of Godhead is. So that's why, in order, there was a need to re-establish the Vedas. Therefore, Krishna instructed Lord Shiva to re-establish the Vedas in the form of covered Buddhism. Covered Buddhism. Mayavadam, Ashat Shastram, Prachanna Bodham Uchyate, Mayaiva Vihitam Devi, Kalo Brahmana Murtina. In Vishnu Puran, Lord Shiva is telling Parvati, Maya, I will establish a Matobad, a Siddhanta, a process of life, a process of spiritual life called Mayavad, which is actually prachanna bodham uchyate, which is actually covered Buddhism. Now that has been explained in this way. If Shankaracharya came and tried to establish the Vedas, so we have to understand that that time the whole of India became Buddhist. Practically the entire India became Buddhist. So now to establish the Vedas, he had to do it in a very special way. How Shankaracharya did? Shankaracharya made the point that you all are talking about Nirvana as the goal of life. But and you are saying Nirvana means to become nothing. Shunna. To become nothing. But actually, Nirvana doesn't mean to become nothing. Nirvana is actually a Vedic concept. And that Nirvana actually means to merge in the Brahma Jyoti. Nirvana is not a Buddhist concept. Nirvana is a Vedic concept. And so he established the theory that to merge into the Absolute is the goal of life, which is Nirvana. And in this way he re-established the Vedas. But the Vedas have been re-established, but the actual teachings of the Vedas have not been properly established. Therefore, after that, in order to establish the real teachings of the Vedas, Ramanujacharya came, Madhvacharya came, Nimbarkacharya came, and Vishnu Swami came in four different sampradayas. In Sri Sampradaya appeared Ramanujacharya, in Brahma Sampradaya, Madhvacharya, in Rudra Sampradaya, Vishnu Swami, and in Kumar Sampradaya, Nimbarkacharya. So in this way, these four Acharyas appeared in four Sampradayas and reinforced their Sampradayas. So the first one to come was Ramanujacharya. Out of these, like Shankaracharya established his Mayavad, Mayavad has different names. Maya, Vad. The Sanskrit real Sanskrit concept is actually called Vivartavad. Vivartavad. Vivartavad means theory of illusion. And another name, the actual name of his Siddhanta is Keval Advaitavad. Keval Advaitavad. Pure non-dualism, advaitavad, keval, absolute non-dualism.
Now Shankaracharya actually derived that theory in a very interesting way. You see, Vedas follow the transformation theory. Brahma Parinambad. Brahma became transformed into Jagat. Sarvam Khalidam Brahma. Everything is a transformation of spiritual energy, Brahma. That is the Vedic understanding. Parinam means transformation. Like Kshirang Yathadadhi Vikara Visheshu Yoga. Just as milk becomes transformed into yogurt. Milk is a substance, yogurt is a substance, yogurt is a transformation of milk. That is the Parinam, transformation. But Shankaracharya established a new theory that is over and above that theory of transformation as Vivartavad, the theory of illusion. Theory of illusion is something like it's not there, but it appears to be. And he gave an example, just as there is no water in a mirage, but it appears that the water is there. So that is illusion. It appears to be, but it is not there. A snake, a rope is mistaken to be a snake. There is no snake in a rope. But the rope, it appears that the rope is a snake. So these are the examples of theory of illusion that he gave, or Vivarta. Theory of illusion. It's illusion, it's not there. And in simple words, he presented it as Brahma Satya, Jagat Mithya. This is illusion, it's mitha. Brahma is the satya, Brahma is the truth, and this jagat is false. False means illusion. And Shankaracharya very expertly did that, he established. And he practically drove out Buddhism from the subcontinent of India. But then there was a need. Now Vedas have been established. Now there is a need to establish the real teachings of the Vedas. Not Vivartavad, but not Nirvisheshvad, but Svabisheshvad. Personalism, not impersonalism. Impersonalism is not the goal of the Vedas. The goal of the Vedas is personalism. So Ramanujacharya came. And Ramanujacharya defeated Shankaracharya's Kevaladvaitavad through his Vishishtadvaitavad. Vishishtadvaitavad is like Vishishta Advaitavad, a special non-dualism. From absolute non-dualism to special non-dualism. And he defeated Shankaracharya's points in this way. His point is that, oh fine, there is no water in the mirage. But somewhere the water is existing, that's why there's a mistake. The mirage is mistaken to be water. So if the water didn't exist, then there was no question of mistaking a mirage to be water. Okay, there is no snake in the rope, but somewhere the snake is existing, therefore the rope is mistaken to be a snake. So this may be mitha, but somewhere the satya is existing. That's why we are considering this to be satya, the illusion. The illusion is there because reality is there. If the real thing was not existing, there was no question of mistaking that to be existing. And in this way, Ramanujacharya defeated Shankaracharya's thing by saying, okay, this may be not the reality, but somewhere the real reality is existing. And that's why we are mistaking this to be real. So where is that reality? That reality is the spiritual sky. And this material nature is a perverted reflection of the spiritual sky. This material nature is only a perverted reflection. Urdhamulam adharshakham ashattam prahur abhayam chandangshi jasapatrani jastam vedasabe. This material nature is like a endless banyan tree that has its root upwards, branches downwards. Now, where is a tree that has its root upwards and branches downwards? In a reflection. When we see a tree in a river, in a pool of water, how does the tree appear to be? Upside down. So this is the material nature, the reflection of the spiritual reality. But the absolute reality, the absolute truth is in the spiritual reality. Ramanujacharya's life is extremely brilliant and extremely exciting life. Ramanujacharya was a brilliant personality from his childhood. He was born in 1017. So that means 993 years ago. And he lived for 120 years. He left his body at 1137. And out of that 120 years, he lived 80 years in Srirangam. And before that, his 40 years of his life was very, very exciting. He was a young boy, extremely brilliant, but he was a devotee. And those days in South India, the influence of Shaiv impersonalism, as I mentioned, like Shankaracharya's teaching, was very, very prevalent. And they were opposed to bhakti, because bhakti naturally goes into personal. So Ramanujacharya was initially initiated by an impersonalist, brilliant, very extremely powerful personalities named Jadav Prakash. And one day Jadav Prakash was explaining a verse that has an expression called kopyasam. Kopyasam. Kopi means, his explanation was, the actual statement was, the eyes of the Supreme Personality of Godhead is kopyasam. He used the expression. Kopyasam. And he explained that word kopi asam, said kopi means a monkey and asam means the behind. So he said that the eyes of the Supreme Personality of Godhead is reddish like the behind, the hind part of a monkey. Ramanujacharya was a little boy. Little boy means he was about 12 years old at that time. When he heard the explanation of his guru, hot tears fell off his eyes and fell on the body of his guru, because he was fanning him. So he looked up and he said, "What happened?" And he said, The eyes of the Supreme Personality of Godhead are the most beautiful things. And you are comparing that with the hind part of a monkey. So he became very upset. He said, what do you mean? That is the explanation. Kopyasam. So he said, "No, that's not the meaning. The real meaning is kong pibati iti kopi. That drinks water." Kong means water, pibati, drinks. Who drinks water? Lotus. And the eyes of the Supreme Personality of Godhead is red like the lotus. That drinks water. You are stunned. But he saw that this is going to be a threat to their sampradaya in the future. This personality, even as a boy, if he has such wisdom, what will happen when he grows up? He will destroy our siddhanta, of our acharya. I mean, he predicted it right. He saw it right. He saw that Ramanujacharya was the biggest threat to their Advaitavad philosophy. So he arranged to get him killed. So Ramanujacharya, they took him on a pilgrimage. They said, we'll go to the pilgrimage in the Ganges to see the Ganges to North India. And so they traveled through the forest, and the idea was to kill him in the middle of the forest. But Ramanujacharya's cousin, Govinda, he found out about that. So he already informed him that this is what happened and told him to run away. So Ramanujacharya fled from the team. And anyway, so they came back after pilgrimage. They thought, okay, we didn't have to kill him. Maybe some animal has eaten him up. So they thought, okay, fine. We didn't have to get involved in the sin of killing somebody. The animals of the forest has taken care of him. But when they returned home, they found Ramanuja was there. And Ramanujacharya later on, actually it is considered that Ramanujacharya's original guru was Jamunacharya. Jamunacharya was another brilliant personality who became a king. How did he become a king, Jamunacharya? Do you know how he became a king? He was 8 years old. When he was 8 years old, he was staying in his guru's ashram. A person called Kolahal, he was patronized by the king, and he was defeating the scholars to establish his supremacy. And he used to collect tax from them. So one day this tax collector came to collect tax from Ramanujacharya's guru. So he asked him that how come, thank you. So they said that your guru has to pay the money, tax. So why my guru has to pay tax? So they said that my guru has defeated your guru and the condition is that he'll have to pay tax. So this boy, little boy, responded by saying, by seeing the disciple one can see what kind of guru he has, what his guru is like. By seeing you I can see what your guru must be like. So if you accept that, I don't accept that your guru has defeated my guru. Rather I challenge your guru. Let him first defeat me and then let him claim that he defeated my guru. But they became furious. They went back to the king and said that this boy is speaking like that. So when Kolahal heard that, he became furious. He said, you have to punish this boy. The king said, actually what he said is right. He challenged you. So you have to accept his challenge. So then the messengers went to this 8-year-old boy, Jamunacharya, said, okay, king has asked you to come and have a debate with Kolahal. Jamunacharya said, see, I am the challenger, so your guru should come to me, not that I should go to him. And if at all he wants me to go there, then he must make proper arrangements for my going there in proper way. So Kolahal, when he was informed that, he became even more furious. And he said, he told the king, I told you, you have to punish this boy. He has become so arrogant, he dares to insult me. The king said, see, what he said is right. Now either you go there because he's the challenger, or let us make arrangements to bring him. So king sent his men with palanquin and other entourage to bring him. So the queen became quite thrilled with this development. The Queen said that it seems that your kolahal now is going to meet his right match. The king said, see, kolahal, he defeated all the scholars. What chance does an 80-year-old boy stand in front of him? The queen said, no, just as a small little fire can burn out the whole heap of cotton wool, this boy is going to defeat your kolahal. So king said, what are you talking about? He's only 8 years old. And he may be, you can understand that kolahal is not an easy one to defeat. He defeated all the scholars all over India. Then queen said, if kolahal can defeat this boy, then I will become the maidservant of your maidservant. The king said, it's a terrible vow that you have taken. So anyway, since you have taken that vow, I also have to match your thing, condition. If this boy can defeat kolahal, then I'll give him half of my kingdom. So then the boy came, brought in a brilliant looking 8-year-old boy, came to that thing, and kolahal started to ask him one after another question, and the boy very easily started to defeat all his questions. So when he was exhausted, then he said, okay, now you can ask questions. So Jamunacharya said, first thing he said when he appeared there, he said that this boy is going to defeat me. Kolahal said. Then Jamunacharya said that it is said that a stupid person should keep his mouth shut. Because as soon as he opens his mouth, everybody can see what a stupid he is. He said, do you think wisdom lies on age? If wisdom was the matter of age, then this tree that is standing out there for hundreds of years would have been the wisest person. And so then they started the debate. Then when he challenged Jamunacharya that you can ask questions, then he said, no, I don't ask you questions. Now you're allowing me to, at first you say, I'm so young, I'm just a little boy. But when it came to attack, you started to attack without giving me a chance to ask you questions. And now that you have become exhausted with your queries, you don't have anything more to ask because I have answered all your questions. Now, as if you're doing me a great favor, allowing me to ask you questions. I'm not going to ask you questions. I'll simply make 3 statements. And if you can negate those 3 statements, then I'll accept defeat. So the first point he made is the queen is barren. The queen is not barren. The queen is not barren. So in order to defeat that, he had to say the queen is barren. So he started to scratch his head. And he told the king, see, what kind of question he is asking? Then he asked, The first point actually was, your mother is not barren. Your mother is not barren. And so that in order to say that, he had to say his mother is barren. Now how could he say that? Because he is the son of his mother. Then the second point he made is that the queen is chaste. So in order to defeat that, he had to say that the queen is unchaste. If he said that, the king would chop his head off. And the third point he said, the king is virtuous. So in order to defeat that, he had to say that the king is sinful. So that also he couldn't. So he was completely stumped. So he told the king, see, he had been asking this question. Now he'll have to prove that he can prove that. Otherwise, these questions are irrelevant. So then Yamunacharya, one after another, made the point. He said, he quoted a verse from the scripture that says that the mother of one child is as good as barren. So since Kolahal is the only son of his mother is as good as barren. The queen, at the time of getting married, was also considered to be married to the demigods, because the king is the representative of the demigods. So when she was married to the king, she was also married to the demigods. So she had more than one husband. Therefore, she is not chaste, according to the scriptural understanding. And the king takes 1/6 of the sinful reactions of his citizens. So because he is the king, although he is extremely virtuous, he has been stained by the sins of his citizens. So this is how Kolahal was defeated. And the queen said, now you give him the half of your kingdom. So this is how Yamunacharya became a king. Originally he was not a king, he was a Brahmana boy. But in this way he became the king. And then Yamunacharya, at some point, he retired from his kingdom and committed himself completely in serving Sri Ranganath in Sri Rangam. So Yamunacharya was a stalwart acharya who was establishing the cult of bhakti. And Yamunacharya, when he left, Yamunacharya actually didn't meet Ramanujacharya, or Ramanujacharya didn't meet Yamunacharya. When Yamunacharya was in his last days, his disciples, some of his disciples, he asked them to ask his disciples to go and get Ramanujacharya. So they went and got Ramanujacharya. But when Ramanujacharya arrived, Yamunacharya left his body. Ramanujacharya didn't meet Yamunacharya, but he saw that his three fingers were held back. Curled, three fingers are curled. So it's unusual that somebody, when one lives his body, his fingers become straight. So he asked, was Ramanujacharya's hand like that? They said, no, it was normal. It's only now that it is appearing to be like that. So then Ramanujacharya understood that Yamunacharya has three desires unfulfilled, and that he wanted him to complete that. So he took a vow in front of Yamunacharya's body that I will establish the cult of bhakti established on prapatti or saranagati. One finger opened up, one finger became straight. I will write a commentary on Brahma's Vedanta Sutra defeating the impersonalistic ideas in the form of Vishishtadvaita. Other finger opened up. And then he announced that in order to establish the glory of Parashar Muni, I will name one of my disciples after him. So all three fingers. So that's why, although Ramanujacharya did not personally meet Yamunacharya, but he had his connection, spiritual connection with Yamunacharya. That's why it is the Sampradaya actually sees that way. Ramanujacharya is a disciple of Yamunacharya. And Yamunacharya is the disciple of Nath Muni. So today is Srila Ramanujacharya's appearance day. We are extremely grateful to Ramanujacharya because he established the Siddhanta of personalism over the atheistic concept of Shankaracharya's Advaitavada. Thank you all very much. All glories to Srila Prabhupada. Gaur Premanande. Sri, you have a question? The mic. They actually took them from the Vedas, Upanishads. These were the Vedic statements, but Chaitanya Charitamrita explains that these are the secondary statements, not the principal statements. Right. He just picked up this and, Brahma Satya Jagan Mitha, Sarvam Khalidam Brahma, Aham Brahmasmi. These are secondary statements of the Vedas. And he tried to establish them as the principal statements, principal teaching of the Vedas. Alright? Yes?
Maharaj, you said Nirvana of Buddha of Buddhism means merging, it's like merging in Brahma.
No, Buddhism is merging in nothing, shunya.
Merging in nothing. But Shankaracharya compared Nirvana with Brahma.
Merging in Brahma.
Merging in Brahma. But is it correct? Nirvana is nothing, but Brahma is full. It is not shunya.
Right. Therefore, that's how Shankaracharya could defeat Buddhism. Because Nirvana doesn't mean to merge into nothing.
But it is just opposite.
Yeah.
Actually, Nirvana and Brahma are opposite. How can they be the same?
What, Nirvana?
And Brahma?
No. Brahma Nirvana means negation of your material existence and merging into the reality.
But Brahma is full,
isn't it? Yes. Brahma is the, as Shankaracharya is saying, that Brahma Satya, Brahma is the only truth. And this Brahma, Shankaracharya's statement is, that Brahma is nirakar, nishaktik, nirvishesh. Brahma doesn't have any akar, shape, form. It is nishaktik, doesn't have any potency. And it doesn't have any variety. But that is the partial perception of Brahman. The actual perception of Brahman is the Supreme Personality of God. When you see from a distance and see the light, then that is nirakar nishakti. But still not nishakti, because light is shakti. But it is nirvishesh. So therefore Shankaracharya's theory is known as nirvisheshvad, impersonality.
But it is happening or quiet?
No, Brahma is totally different. Brahma is not shunya, Brahma is purna. So that's how he defeated Buddha. It's not he's conformed with Buddhism. He defeated Buddhism by saying that Brahman, Nirvana means to merge with Brahman. And Brahman is the absolute truth, absolute reality. So that is the ultimate goal, not merging into nothing. नहीं, God realization के बारे में या God के बारे में, भगवान के बारे में बुद्धदेव कुछ नहीं बोला। बुद्धदेव वैसे भगवान के बारे में जब कोई प्रश्न किया, तो कोई जवाब नहीं दिया, मतलब भगवान के बारे में बुद्धदेव कुछ नहीं पता है। वो भगवान के, भगवान को जानने के लिए संन्यास नहीं लेते, वो लोग संन्यास लेते हैं अपने आप को खत्म करने के लिए। उनका मतवाद ये है कि ये शरीर सारे क्लेश के कारण है, ये शरीर को खत्म कर दो तो क्लेश नहीं रहेगा। सिंपली दैट इज द कंक्लूशन ऑफ बुद्धिज्म, द बॉडी इज द सोर्स ऑफ सफरिंग, सो गेट रिड ऑफ द बॉडी, देयर वोंट बी एनी सफरिंग। एंड प्रभुपाद यूज्ड टू से इन दैट रिस्पेक्ट दैट यू गॉट अ बॉयल इन योर लेग, राइट, सो कट द लेग ऑफ, देयर वोंट बी एनी बॉयल। यस, take the mic.
In the very beginning of your discourse today, you mentioned about this wonderful queens following in the footsteps of their husband.
I mentioned what at the beginning?
The queen of
and
Sita Devi performing in the footsteps of their husband. Yeah, I don't know about India, I'm a foreigner. In other parts of the world, it is gradually a fashion now of ladies to put their husbands, particularly if they follow and take the path of devotion and associate with the Hare Krishna movement. Yeah, my question, I have two questions arising from that. What should a person do in this situation? Number one.
In what situation?
Like where? A man's life becomes intolerable simply because he's associating and trying his best to follow, like the bhakti, the Hare Krishna process is similar, where the wife wants a good material enjoyment and whatnot, and she's happy to put the husband out because in other countries she'll get at least a minimum of 50% of the share of the assets, where she hasn't even contributed a cent towards it.
So what to do?
Yeah, what to do? Number two.
Okay, first let me answer number one.
Okay.
If that is the case, one, there are many options that you can take. One option can be that give her 50% and take the other 50% and move into ISKCON temple. Okay, what's your second question?
Okay, moving in the ISKCON temple, it's not practical.
It's not practical? Don't tell us.
I'm not the only one, but particularly in later years of your life. And then the second question that I think from this was, a person may need a company, right? Company of the object sex, just simply to be together, to help each other, and to be in service together. For example, when one becomes sick, nobody would know whether the person is sick or in coma or unconscious. At least there will be somebody there. They are take care of the person, to take care of the people, to be recovered or vice versa. Now, is that the responsibility?
Well, everything is, you know, ultimately we have to be practical and we have to see what's the most practical option. But the reality is, you know, for how long can you help each other? Like, you may think that your wife will help you when you become sick. What if she becomes sick before you? Then you have to take care of her. Right? And even at an old age. Then finally you have seen, which country do you live in? You live in Australia. Okay, you're seeing what's happening to the old people there. Their wife don't take care of them, their children don't take care of them. When the man becomes old, the wife takes her 50% and goes away with somebody else. Right?
They do take care of each other, but when, for example...
What if she doesn't take care of you? What will you do? And most cases, that's what is happening.
What happens?
Tell me, how many marriages last beyond 20 years? in Australia. How many marriages last not even 20 years, last beyond 10 years?
Oh, very few last beyond a few years.
Right, that's what I mean. Right, right. So the point is, you know, materialistic culture, materialistic way of life is not a very pleasant one. Therefore, I was pointing out the real human civilization is the Vedic culture. In Vedic culture, not only the wife, the whole family will take care of you when you have difficulty. Right? And that is what ISKCON is trying to establish all over the world. And as I was saying, move into ISKCON temple. When you move into ISKCON temple, then what happens? Then 100 devotees take care of you when you have difficulty. It's a family where there are so many, and so many members, so many, you know, caring persons around you. Then maybe you have to go to America to have a better treatment. There are temples, there are devotees, there they are going to take care of you.
In theory, in practice, that's what ISKCON family should be, we want to buy as a greater family. But in reality, it's far, far away from it. Maybe you are moving towards...
Which city you live in Australia?
In Brisbane, and I'm very good
in
Brisbane.
Yeah, so in Brisbane... I was in Brisbane last week. And in Brisbane there is a very nice community. Do you go to ISKCON temple there?
Yes, I am a very regular in there.
Regularly. You know Sakirai?
Yes.
Okay, I'll give you an example. You see, one of my disciples was traveling with me at that time. And he became sick. And Sakirai and Janak Raj, you know Janak Raj? So they just took care of him. Like, in all respects, I didn't have to worry about it, him at all. So, and you still say that it's far from being practical. ISKCON is still a family. Whenever we are in difficulty, we are seeing how others come forward. And Sakirai is such a wonderful example. You know him. He's such a caring person. And there are so many devotees like that. Anyway, I mean, my point is, Vedic culture is the ideal human culture. Yes, maybe in ISKCON we haven't been able to establish it properly as yet. But we are trying. Come consider, you know, how old is ISKCON movement? It's only 45 years old, this movement. Not even 45, 44 years old, this movement. Now, for a spiritual movement in 45 years, can you imagine Christianity 45 years after Jesus' crucifixion, what it was like? Islam after 45 years after its inception by Muhammad, what it was like? Buddhism, 44 years after Buddha's death, what it was like. The spiritual movement takes time. Christianity took, what Christianity is today is a result of 2,000 years. What Islamism is today is a result of 1,000 years. So give ISKCON a few hundred years at least. And I tell you, ISKCON will establish the perfect human culture in this world. Thank you. Hare Krishna. So I'll stop now.